Iran says a recent meeting between the top U.S., Israeli and Saudi officials in Saudi Arabia was to hatch anti-Tehran plots, resulting in the assassination of Iran's nuclear scientist. Iran censors the IAEA over its silence on the assassination of the country's prominent nuclear scientist, calling on the agency to strongly condemn the terrorist attack. Also coming up, 29 arms control and rights organizations oppose the planned U.S. arms sales to the UAE, citing the Arab country's involvement in Yemen and Libya conflicts. Thank you for joining us. Our top story, Iran's foreign minister says the assassination of Iranian scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was the result of plots hatched in a recent meeting between top U.S., Israeli and Saudi officials in Saudi Arabia. We discussed the matter at length in our news review program. Welcome. Iran says the supporters of the U.S.'s so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran are making a last-ditch effort to escalate tensions. In an Instagram post, Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif said anti-Iran hawks are using the final days of the current U.S. administration to rule out a possibility of lifting oppressive sanctions on Tehran. He pointed to U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's recent trip to the region and trilateral talks with Israeli and Saudi officials in Saudi Arabia. He said their plots culminated in the killing of Iranian scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh on Friday. Zarif also mentioned a foreign-led campaign on social media to undermine the 2015 Iran nuclear deal and Tehran's cooperation with the International Atomic Energy Agency. He, however, underlined that Iran will not play into the hands of international terrorists and Zionist warmongers. Joining us is David Yerubiano, professor of history, and also George Sazmueli, a senior research fellow at the Global Policy Institute. Gentlemen, welcome. And George, if I can start with you, some Iranian officials say it doesn't matter who sits in the White House, different sides of the same coin. There have always been assassinations, sanctions, and maximum pressure. And Iran has countered that. It's not, going to bow down to America. Having said that, are those who are meeting and plotting for Washington's policy over the next 4 years, are they wasting their time?
Well, I think the people that you characterize, I think they're absolutely right. I don't expect any major change in U.S. policy toward Iran under a Biden administration. For Biden to attempt to get back into the JCPOA, he would have to antagonize the powerful Zionist lobby in the United States. He would have to antagonize Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, the Gulf states. He doesn't need the headaches. He doesn't really identify with that policy. That was Obama's policy. Obama can live with that. So I don't expect any major changes from a Biden administration. And I think Iran mentioned the other day and likened an apt parallel, which is what happened after Jimmy Carter lost in 1980. And Iran, in a goodwill gesture, release the American hostages, expecting probably some rapprochement with the incoming Reagan administration. It never happened. Reagan kept the sanctions on, and I think the same thing will happen. I don't think that the incoming Biden administration will lift any of the sanctions or will ease up on the maximum pressure campaign.
Professor Rubian, do you see any links between an increase in meetings between the United States, Saudi Arabia, and Israel, and the shaping of Washington's policy on Iran, perhaps under a Biden administration?
I see these meetings, specifically the meeting with Pompeo, Netanyahu, and Mohammed bin Salman just about a week ago. enable two things. One is discussion of potential rapprochement with Saudi Arabia, which would further entrench the Israeli apartheid regime. But also, I believe that this was a way to enable Benjamin Netanyahu to spread the blame around for this heinous murder of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. So by meeting so recently with Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudis themselves are also implicated, as they should be. And I think that this was Netanyahu's way of helping to spread the blame for this murder to its regional allies. So regarding the Biden administration, though, unfortunately, I have to agree with my colleague in Budapest, despite the fact that Biden coming out of originally, of course, the 8 years of the Obama presidency as vice president, I feel like he, to a certain extent, has a personal debt that he owes to John Kerry and to Barack Obama to at least provide a semblance of respect for the agreement and lip service to it. But again, unfortunately, I agree with my colleague that we cannot count on a Biden administration to buck the Zionist lobby and the military-industrial complex, considering Biden's own personal mental circumstances, let's just say, and as well all of the other pressures that his incoming administration is going to be facing.
George, Zarif also says anti-Iran hawks are using the final days of the current U.S. administration to prevent the lifting of what he describes as oppressive sanctions on Iran. Do you see it that way?
Well, there may be an element of that. I think that may well be the thinking of people such as Pompeo. I tend to think that Donald Trump has got enough on his plate right now. I mean, he's completely preoccupied with challenging the election result. I don't think he's thinking very much now about Iran. And to a certain extent, if he is planning to run again in 2024, it might actually serve his interests better if Biden were to return to the JCPOA, because then he would use that as a cudgel with which to beat Biden. So I don't think he necessarily would want Biden then to continue with his policy. I think, you know, he might want to think that it's politically advantageous for him if Biden were to reverse what he had done.
Right. And finally, Professor Yerubian, Zarif essentially saying there are strong supporters in the region of Washington's so-called maximum pressure campaign that has killed Iranian civilians. What do you make of that?
I think that it's a true statement that is borne out by the increasingly close relationship between the Emiratis and the Zionists, between the Bahrainis and the Zionists, between the Saudis and the Zionists. And so I think that he is spot on. I think that the Emiratis especially understand that Iran is paying close attention to the allied relationships in the region as they are developing, and has a plan to defend itself and as well to punish those who are supporting this aggression against the Islamic Republic. And so therefore I see this as the context in which the UAE put out a relatively very strong statement condemning this assassination. I think the UAE is very well aware of the fact that it is fully implicated in this, and the maximum pressure campaign that the Trump regime has been perpetrating against Iran. And so, therefore, it's not just Zarif and Iranian observers who are aware of the complicity of the regional Gulf states in supporting these evil crimes of the American Empire and of the Zionist apartheid state of Israel.
Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed for your contribution. Let me thank our guests, David Yerubian, a professor of history, George Sazmoueli, a senior research fellow at the Global Policy Institute. Meanwhile, Iran's parliament speaker Mohammed Baqir Ghalibaf has urged the international community to condemn the assassination of top Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. In a separate letter, in a separate message, that is, to international organizations, including the UN chief, Ghalibaf stressed the need to pursue the punishment of the perpetrators of Friday's organized terrorist attack. He said the international community's silence and inaction will make the perpetrators and their backers more brazen, and that they will continue to pose a threat to the world. The top parliamentarian said Iran, that has always played a key role in establishing regional and global peace and security, as well as in combating terrorism, reserves the right to act against organized terror acts. The head of the Iranian judiciary's High Council for Human Rights says the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh is in line with the US's maximum pressure policy to stop the Islamic Republic's progress.
The U.S.'s maximum pressure policy has two parts. The first is sanctions and embargoes that during Barack Obama's tenure was pursued and affected people's livelihoods. This policy was intensified under Donald Trump, and sanctions were extended to medicine and medical equipment. Because Iran and the U.S. have no relations, the burden fell on the European countries, meaning that the White House approved the sanctions and Europe imposed the embargoes. The second part of this maximum pressure policy is that they commit crimes and assassinate our elites. Again, this began during the Obama era and is not something new. At least 5 Iranian nuclear scientists were assassinated during his tenure. The latest assassination is in line with that policy. Assassinations and sanctions both serve the same goal, which is to stop the Iranian nation's progress and development. They can be considered as crimes against humanity. The silence of the West and international organizations and their failure to condemn the assassination can be interpreted as legitimizing terrorism, which makes them partners to the crime. Terrorism is part of the U.S. foreign policy that America uses to reach its objectives. We have begun the legal procedures to find perpetrators of the crime and bring them to justice.
Iran's envoy to the Vienna-based international organizations has called on the International Atomic Energy Agency to strongly condemn the assassination of the nuclear scientist. Kazem Gharib Abadi said the IAEA has a dire responsibility in relation a member that is receiving the agency's highest level of inspections and having the most transparent nuclear program. He added, despite his country's commitments, Iranian scientists are assassinated or under threat of assassination, and its nuclear facilities are sabotaged. Gharib Abadi made the remarks after the head of the UN nuclear watchdog said no one, including Iran, would benefit from decreasing or limiting its cooperation with the agency. But he added that so far the IAEA has not received any signal from Iran that anything would change regarding inspections of nuclear facilities. Iran, Cuba, and Venezuela raise concerns over the impact of unilateral sanctions in light of the COVID-19 pandemic. At a UN seminar in Vienna, Iran's ambassador said banking restrictions have prevented the Islamic Republic from obtaining medicine and medical equipment to fight the coronavirus. Hermeleski reports.
Iran, Cuba, and Venezuela host a virtual seminar at the UN headquarters in Vienna on unilateral sanctions and their impacts in light of the COVID-19 pandemic. The three countries are under crippling US sanctions that have added extra pressure as they struggle to fight the coronavirus. Banking restrictions resulting from the sanctions are affecting the country's ability to obtain medical equipment, a point highlighted by the UN Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights. Iran's ambassador to international organizations in Vienna, Kazem Gharib Abadi, said as the world's biggest imposer of unilateral sanctions, the U.S. should be held accountable for the consequences of its actions.
These sanctions violate human rights in the current circumstances. In our country, we also face a problem in importing medicine and medical equipment from abroad as a result of these cruel unilateral coercive measures and banking restrictions. Those who impose these sanctions have international responsibilities.
The Cuban ambassador said many countries are unaware of the impact that these sanctions are having on countries' healthcare systems and people's normal day-to-day lives.
As a result of this seminar, we will try to impulse all declaration, in all resolution of United Nations, to include the request to the United States and the other country and the European country who impose unilateral coercive measure to lifting those measures, as the Secretary General of the United Nations requests and the High Commissioner of Human Rights.
In a joint statement, representatives of 38 participating countries said unilateral coercive measures are against international law, human rights, and the UN Charter.
Under the current circumstances caused by the coronavirus, they said, sanctions have made targeted countries vulnerable and need to be lifted. Homolezki, Vienna.
Now, the EU describes the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh as a criminal act, but has stopped short of pointing the finger at Israel for the atrocity. Jerome Hughes reports.
We are told that EU officials are monitoring the situation in the Middle East very closely as tensions escalate over the assassination last Friday of senior Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. The 27-nation bloc's foreign policy spokesperson, Peter Stano, gave this reaction when we spoke to him via Skype.
What happened on Friday in the city of Abzaz is a criminal act and runs counter to the principle of respect for human rights for which the European Union is standing for.
One EU lawmaker says Israel orchestrated the attack under false pretenses and in cahoots with the Trump administration to try and scupper Joe Biden's plans to re-engage with Iran in 2021.
People should remember that Iran has no nuclear weapons, despite for the last 25 years Israel crying wolf that they could develop one. Israel has nuclear weapons. So, I mean, which is the bigger danger to peace in the region?
Political commentators say the EU has a pattern of issuing strongly worded statements, but will once again shy away from taking any firm steps against Israel. They say the bloc has turned a blind eye to repeated international law violations perpetrated by Israel and Saudi Arabia. Apparently, this is because the EU does not want to upset the United States, but also trade in weapons and goods to these regimes is worth billions of euro annually. The big question now is, how might Tehran respond to Fakhrizadeh's murder? And what impact could any such response have on ambitions under a Biden presidency to save the Iran nuclear deal?
Tehran has always insisted its nuclear energy program is purely peaceful. Security analysts say the Israeli regime and the very powerful Israel lobby in Washington have shown time and time again the last thing in the world they want is peace with Iran. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Elsewhere, dozens of arms control and human rights organizations have denounced the U.S. plan to sell multi-billion dollars worth of arms to the United Arab Emirates. In a letter to the U.S. State Department and Congress, 29 advocacy groups warned that arming the UAE would cause more humanitarian crisis as the country is party to the conflicts in Yemen and Libya. Earlier this month, the administration of President Donald Trump announced the approval of $23 billion arms sales, including F-35 fighter jets, missiles, and drones to the UAE. The announcement came on the heels of a U.S. brokered mobilization deal between the UAE and the Israeli regime in September. Saudi Arabia has agreed to let Israeli commercial planes cross its airspace en route to the United Arab Emirates. A senior U.S. official has been quoted as saying that the agreement was reached following talks between Saudi officials and White House senior advisor Jared Kushner. The kingdom had already allowed the first direct Israeli commercial passenger flight over its airspace to reach the UAE in September after Tel Aviv and Abu Dhabi agreed to normalize ties. Kushner is leading a team to Saudi Arabia and is scheduled to meet Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. He would later visit Qatar to hold talks with Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani. U.S. media say Kushner is eager to persuade the two countries to reconcile after 3 years of Saudi-led blockade of Qatar. That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Elephants are really cute and interesting animals. They are one of the most intelligent types of animals on Earth. Elephants are emotional animals. Feelings like sympathy and altruism are visibly seen among them. However, these cute, clever animals have big ivories, which have made them exposed to the danger of extinction. The biggest enemies of elephants are humans, and this animosity is due to the fact that humans are after the elephant's ivory. It's a shame, of course. Well, today I'm going to visit a place in northern Iran, to the Ivory Museum of Ramsar. About 90 years ago, a building under the area of 578 square meters was built in the city of Ramsar in Mazandaran province. This magnificent structure has placed a unique museum inside. The Ivory Museum of Iran is the first specialized ivory museum in the West Asia region. This museum displays a very rare collection of artworks, including ivory carvings and fine art on ivory, which is very attractive. This museum includes 300 valuable artworks, which have been created by the artists of the East and Southeast Asia, as well as parts of Africa. Among the distinguished artworks showcased in this museum, mention can be made of different types of statues and decorative artifacts. I am now standing by the building of Ramsar Ivory Museum. This two-story building is white in color and looks really gorgeous. And the area around the building is a green space, which is so pleasant. Well, let's enter this really pretty building. Ivory Museum of Rome, sir, consists of different sections, including the Chamber of Human Statues, the Chamber of Arms, the Chamber of Non-Human Statues, the Chamber of Elephants, and the Chamber of Decorative Objects. First of all, I'm going to visit the Chamber of Non-Human Statues. Stay with me. I am now in front of a very big window showcase, and regrettably, the first thing seen in this showcase is the huge foot of an elephant. Oh, I'd better skip this showcase. It makes me depressed. Okay, behind this showcase, there are small, delicate statues of different animals, all made of elephant ivory, including panther, crocodile, and even a tiny rat. Here's the Chamber of Human Statues. Wish you were here to see these delicate statues of men and women in here. Here there are statues of two East Asian men who are playing chess. Oh, the details of these statues are really unbelievable. Even the hair strands of these statues are delicately made. Well, I am now in the Chamber of Arms. Here there are daggers fully made of ivory. And here there are swords with the ivory-made hilt. Oh, and how cute! Here there are plenty of sticks which have ivory decorations. I don't know since when sticks became known as arms. I am now in the Chamber of Decorative Objects of the Ivory Museum. Just across from me, there is a beautiful ship with incredible details. Its beauty is indescribable. You have to come here to see all these beauties and delicacies. Oh, look at here! It's a wooden folding screen with frames which have lots of beautiful pictures on them made of ivory. What beautiful flowers! These flowers look so real that you feel like you want to pick them each. Well, it's as if all the art and beauty created by the innovative fingers of humans have been gathered here. However, we should not forget that all these beauties have been at the cost of the lives of thousands of elephants. Was it really worth it? I suppose not. Until next time, goodbye!
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know. What should I do?
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran, all big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. In this program, we're going to look at some principles of upbringing children so that the audience gets a detailed description of the matter concerning how to raise the children Islamically. The answers are mostly based upon the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. And we have in our studio guest speaker Sister Salma Khalfan, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program, dear Sister Salma Khalfan.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for inviting me over.
And thank you very much for coming. From the previous two episodes, we've been talking about the role of the father in upbringing the children.
Yeah.
And you mentioned some beautiful points, and we even mentioned a couple of prophets from the Holy Quran who are our role models,
yeah,
which are Prophet Ibrahim and Prophet Ya'qub.
Yeah.
So we continue with Prophet Ya'qub.
Yes, just a little bit on that so that the audience can get a clearer picture.
Yes.
Is that when we talked about the fact that Hazrat Yusuf was, very much more intimate with his father,
mm-hmm,
the father used to love him very much so,
true,
is because, mm-hmm, of course, that character of Prophet Yusuf, that came from his mother. You know, the 11 brothers were very good. They were very, they could be very good, but because they had different mothers also,
mm-hmm,
who some of them were good, some of them were, all right in character.
Mm-hmm.
But Hazrat Yusuf's mother was a very good charactered lady.
Mm-hmm. So that's why basically upbringing is from both, mother
yeah,
and father.
That's right.
Okay.
And of course, all the things that were taught to him from childhood, as he started growing up, he could take it more quicker.
Mm-hmm.
And he could accept it, and he could also show it in a way that provided that satisfaction to Prophet Ya'qub that this child was growing up to be the prophet in future. So that's why, like he said, that I don't want to spread this hatred between you and your brothers, so keep this a secret. There was a secret communication.
Mm-hmm.
That communication, which was intimate, should be like that between the fathers and the sons.
The sons,
yes. That's very important.
Which I think many of the fathers, or I can say not only fathers, but even like parents in general, lack.
You know how we can actualize that? I felt when I was reading this, how to actualize this is that when the father talks to the child about what is so important to him in life. For example, as far as religion is concerned, as far as God is concerned, as far as the imams are concerned, you know, this usul-e-deen, it's such an important thing that as your son or your daughter grows up, you can have an intelligent conversation with them. It doesn't mean telling out your secrets to the child that, in my business I faced this loss, and when I was a child I did these mistakes. No, that position of the fatherhood should be there always so that the son can deeply respect the father. But that intimate conversation is that when the father feels that, I want to talk to this about my passions, my likes and dislikes, especially about religion, he should not hesitate to do that. For example, if he feels very strongly about Imam Ali alayhi salam, and he wants to feel like he wants to go to a gathering, and all these emotions, he can talk to the child that, I feel so strongly about Imam Ali, and I feel so sad at this incident. Share it with him.
Yeah.
Those deep kind of emotional things that really touches a father, he should easily share it with a growing person.
I think, unfortunately, in these days of ours, in these times of ours, because of the technology, we kind of lack that communication between us and our children.
But it's very sad also.
Very, very sad, yes. Inshallah, we'll continue after the break. Let's take a break, dear listeners. Stay tuned and don't go away. We'll be back soon.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir. Welcome back. This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. You were mentioning about the bond of Hazrat Yaqub and Prophet Yusuf and how he had that very beautiful connection with his son.
Yeah.
Yes.
Of communication. Now I would like to cite another example of how to express love and affection through action from the ayats about the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, who was an exemplar when it came to showing love and compassion to all the people around him.
Yes.
And he's described by Allah to be a mercy to the worlds, not only this world, all the worlds. Surah Anbiya, ayat number 107, "And we have not sent you, O Muhammad, except as a mercy to the worlds." So of course this mercy has to be shown to whom, a child that he's raising also, right?
Yes, true.
In his own home. And that's how the Holy Prophet was never shy to show respect and love for his own daughter, the Fatimatu Zahra, salamullahi alayha.
I guess sometimes we think when we show respect to the younger ones, we kind of become
little. But that's not true. It's the opposite, that the Holy Prophet laid us an example on that, yeah?
True.
So even in the presence of others, he used to show so much respect, like he used to stand up, which is a big thing for his daughter. Like hardly fathers stand up for the children. So this is something that of course Fatimatu Zahra also was such kind of a dignified lady of paradise, so she deserved that kind of respect. But yeah, this respect should be there for the children, very much so. So this displays the deep affection and respect that Fatimatu Zahra.
Yeah, like he used to greet all the children first. I read a story saying that he'd always be the first one to greet the children. Even every time the kids would try to greet him first, but he'd be the first one to greet. But I guess in our, this thing, we find it very bad if the kids do not say salam first.
Yeah, that's very wrong actually. Yeah.
I guess by doing it ourselves, we actually teach them and they would gradually just do it themselves as well.
Yeah, so especially when fathers, would they come home and they should do the first salam, right?
Yes.
To show this respect to the children.
And that would go on to the next generation as well.
And another thing it shows about the fathers, how they can emulate from this example, is also when they come home, they should not be bottled up. They should mentally tell themselves that they're going to come to their families. So they should have a very, you know, good demeanor to greet their children, their wives. Especially, I feel the children really notice these things, because it may happen, unfortunately, sometimes that the children dread the father to come home.
Yes.
Oh my God, my
especially
father, the father has come. Now, no noise, no TV, no this, no that, right? It shouldn't be like that. The father, when he comes, it should be a waiting hour. Now, father is going to come.
Yeah.
Now, for example, babas are going to come, right? So, Aisha, one of the wives of the Holy Prophet, once said, "I did not see anyone who more resembled the message of Allah in the manner of speaking than Fatima herself." So it seeps in the child. How you behave, it goes back to the child. That's again about being a good role model. When she came to him, he stood up for her, made her welcome, kissed her, and had her sit in his place. When the Prophet came to her, she stood up for him, took his hand, made him welcome, kissed him, and made him sit in her place. She came to him during his last illness, and he greeted her and kissed her. This is in one of the books of Hadith. That is, of course, a hadith that we can relate to in our Shia books also. So there was an inseparable connection between the father and the daughter, which lasted a lifetime, and for others to emulate and learn from. So you see, when the father respects the children like this, then when they become old, the children will respect them in the same way.
Exactly.
It's just give and take. And this is how the principle of Allah works. True. Whatever you earn, you get it, you know, the same way. So if you are indifferent and you come and say, oh my God, my I won't get time to rest now. You know, what do I do? I just have to go to my room and sleep. Instead of, you know, trying to mingle with the children, then know that even when you get old, a father, that's how the children will feel, that now I have to now take care of my father and I can't go places. What do I do?
Okay. We'll continue after the break. Dear listeners, stay tuned and we'll be back soon.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
مسند ابن حنبل narrating from Walid ibn Uqba, who said, when the Prophet of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wasallam conquered Mecca, the people of Mecca came to him with their children, and he patted them over their heads and prayed for them.
Welcome back. This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. We were talking about the third prophet, the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and his inseparable connection with his daughter, Fatima Zahra sallallahu alaiha, and how, according to what one of the wives of the Prophet Aisha said, that she's the best person that she's seen that has acted on Allah's commands, and this is because of the upbringing of her father that, you know, has had an effect on her.
That's right.
Yes.
I guess, you know, when we talk about the Holy Prophet, all the values of all the prophets come together in him,
that's
right? But of course, we pointed out to him as well in particular because he's a mercy. He acts as the epitome of love and affection. That of course, even he, you know, has an intimate conversation with the child. Also, he does dua for the child the way the other prophets did.
But this is one of the things that is outstanding.
Outstands in him, right? So another prophet's example is the imparting of wisdom and good values to your child as a father. It's very important that at every stage, you know, you should know the growth process and the milestones of the child. That now my child can begin to realize such and such concepts.
Okay, that's very important, I think, because we lack information or, you know, as to when
to do what, right?
When to do what.
Or what is immature in the child, so that not to go on that, right?
Yes,
so a father should really watch his child growing up. Like, what are the milestones of his child? That now his brain has developed in such a way that if I talk about emotional aspects, he will take it. Or just now if I talk about this intellectual aspects, he will realize that and he will know it and he will value it also. And it will be a very good lesson for him. So this is how Hazrat Luqman acted with his child. Luqman was given wisdom by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that he used to impart good values to his son in helping him to navigate the world with him. So Luqman taught his son the importance of truthfulness and the accountability. You know, like how to account for your deeds. And Luqman said in Surah Luqman, ayat number 16, my dear son, should there be anything good or bad, even to the measure of a mustard seed, and it be hidden in a rock, or in the heavens, or in the earth, Allah will bring it forth. Surely Allah is all fine and all aware. That means he is telling his son, you know, my dear son. First he calls his son, Ya Bunayya, my dear son, which is very important. How you call your son. So the Prophet lays an example as a father. You also are emotional. You also show your love. You don't leave it on the mothers. You call your son or your daughter as my dear child. Ya Bunayya. And then he says, should I tell you what is, you know, that Allah will account even something very small. That's a wise thing. That's something that shows the fact that Allah will account for everything. And he tells his son this. He tries to train his son for the hereafter. You see, training your sons for the hereafter is to tell them about the accountability that will be done in each and every aspect of life.
True, yes. That's a very good point that you mentioned. So we'll stop here and inshallah we'll continue on this in the next episode. Thank you very much for joining us on this program, dear listeners. And if you have any questions, any comments, any suggestions, please contact us at our email. englishradio@irib.ir, and visit us at our website farstoday.com, and subscribe to our YouTube channel and Facebook page Call of Islam Radio. Inshallah, till the next program, fi amanillah.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
A recount in Wisconsin's largest county demanded by President Donald Trump's election campaign ended on Friday, 27th of November, with the president-elect Joe Biden gaining votes. After a recount in Milwaukee County, Joe Biden made a net gain of 132 votes out of nearly 460,000 casts. Overall, the Democrat gained 257 votes to Donald Trump's 125. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at The Guardian, with contributions from Reuters and Associated Press news agencies. The piece is titled, Joe Biden Gains Votes in Wisconsin County After Trump-Ordered Recount. Stay with us for more. A recount in Wisconsin's largest county demanded by President Donald Trump's election campaign ended on Friday, 27th of November, with the president-elect Joe Biden gaining votes. After a recount in Milwaukee County, Joe Biden made a net gain of 132 votes out of nearly 460,000 cast. Overall, the Democrat gained 257 votes to Donald Trump's 125. Trump's campaign had demanded recounts in two of Wisconsin's most populous and Democratic-leaning counties. after he lost Wisconsin to Joe Biden by more than 20,000 votes. The two recounts will cost the Trump campaign $3 million. Dane County is expected to finish its recount on Sunday. Overall, Biden won November's U.S. presidential election with 306 Electoral College votes to Donald Trump's 232. Biden also leads by more than 6 million in the popular vote tally. After the recount ended, the Milwaukee County Clerk, George Christensen, said, "The recount demonstrates that what we already know, that elections in Milwaukee County are fair, transparent, accurate, and secure." The Trump campaign is still expected to mount a legal challenge to the overall result in Wisconsin, but time is running out. The state is due to certify its presidential result next Tuesday. On Friday, Trump's legal team suffered yet another defeat when a federal appeals court in Philadelphia rejected the campaign's latest effort to challenge the state's election results. Trump's lawyers said they would take the case to the Supreme Court despite the Philadelphia judge's assessment that the campaign's claims have no merit. Judge Stefanos Bibas wrote for the three-judge panel, "Free, fair elections are the lifeblood of our democracy. Charges of unfairness are serious, but calling an election unfair does not make it so. Charges require specific allegations and then proof. We have neither here." President Trump continued to maintain without evidence that there was election fraud in the state, tweeting early on Saturday, "The 1,126,940 votes were created out of thin air. I won Pennsylvania by a lot, perhaps more than anyone will ever know." Meanwhile, Donald Trump's baseless claims of electoral fraud in Georgia are increasingly worrying his own party. Republicans are concerned that the chaos caused by Trump's stance and his false comments on the conduct of the election in the key swing state, which Joe Biden won, could hinder his party's efforts to retain control of the Senate. A runoff for Georgia's two Senate seats is scheduled for early January, and if the Democrats clinch both seats, it will give them control of the upper house as well as the House of Representatives. When asked about his previous baseless claims of fraud in Georgia during a Thanksgiving Day press conference, Donald Trump said he was very worried about them, saying, "You have a fraudulent system." He then called the state's Republican Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, who has defended the state's election process, an enemy of the people. Such attacks have Republicans worried as they seek to motivate Georgia voters to come to the polls in early January, volunteer for their state Senate campaigns, and perhaps more important than all, dig deep into their pockets to pay for the unexpected runoff races. In particular, Donald Trump's comments have spurred conspiracy theories that the state's electoral system is rigged and prompted some of his supporters to make calls for a boycott of the coming vote, something that local Georgia Republicans desperately do not want. His demonization of Georgia's entire electoral system is hurting his party's chances at keeping the Senate, warned an article published by the website Politico. Even President Trump's son, Donald Trump Jr., has jumped into the fray in Georgia, tweeting, "I'm seeing a lot of talk from people that are supposed to be on our side telling GOP voters not to go out and vote. That is nonsense. Ignore those people." The president has also pledged to visit Georgia to hold rallies in support of the two Republican candidates, Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue. The first of those events is expected to be on Saturday, 5th of December, and could be a double-edged sword. Donald Trump is still a powerful force with loyal following, whose endorsement is a key mobilization tool for the race. On the other hand, in his freewheeling rallies, Donald Trump may spout conspiracy theories that undermine their campaigns. Certainly, Trump's mood has become increasingly erratic, even as he made the clearest signs yet that he will eventually leave the White House, which he convincingly lost to Joe Biden in both the popular vote and the vital electoral college that actually picks the next president. On Thanksgiving Day, Trump said he would leave the White House when the Electoral College voted for Joe Biden. He has so far defied tradition by refusing to concede defeat and launching legal attempts to challenge the outcome of election in battleground states, including Georgia, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. So far, those legal efforts have all failed. On Thursday, 26th of November, Trump had declined to say whether he would attend Joe Biden's inauguration, which is due to take place on 20th of January, and called one reporter a lightweight, telling him, "Don't talk to me like that." Trump continued his rant on Friday, 27th of November, producing a long string of retweets and tweets making untrue claims about election and his opponent. Trump tweeted, "Biden can only enter the White House as president if he can prove that his ridiculous 80 million votes were not fraudulently or illegally obtained."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.